Hello and welcome to the AIPT Comics Podcast, episode 184. My name is David Brook and I'm here with Nate Sims. We're here to talk about comic books, comic book news, review comic books. We're very serious. In fact, we're not very serious, though. How are you doing, Nathan?
I'm good, man. I'm being very serious today. It's big serious hours over here.
Big serious energy in August as we all try to cool off in this summer heat.
Boy, it's actually not been too bad over here. It's been storming most of the week, so it's been really good, like, make a cup of tea, sit inside, read comic books kind of weather.
Ooh, yeah. That's the perfect kind of weather for comic book reading.
And read comic books I did.
We should do a show on the temperatures and weathers you should experience comic books in.
Oh, I like this. Yeah, yeah.
But I guess it would depend on the location, too, right? Like, if you're in, like, a snowy cabin with a nice fireplace, I mean, what beats that? But then if you're, like, in a cabin in a desert...
Right, not desert cabin. Yeah. Then what are you supposed to read?
Well, that's why we have to break it all down in a future episode. Right. Maybe that'll be our 200th episode, the big finale.
Desert cabin books.
Well, in this show, we also have a special guest Matthew Arnold on to talk about Eden.
Yeah.
It's a Comixology Originals book that is getting a print release from Dark Horse August 30th. I'm going to have to do some editing on that because I think we say the book's coming out like July... Like June 30th, but the book has been delayed over and over, but I think August 30th is the final date. It's pretty cool Dark Horse is putting out Comixology Originals.
Yeah, and this is a fun book. This is Matthew Arnold is known for his TV work, and this is his first big foray into comics.
If you liked Emerald City or Siberia, he was a showrunner on those.
Yeah, and this book, it asks some pretty interesting questions about, you know, the penal system and, and kind of tries to trace where things could go if left unchecked. And it's an interesting, heady sci-fi concept with just enough action to keep you on your toes.
It definitely had a lot of cliffhangers. To the point where I was like, this is a cliffhanger. This is a cliffhanger book.
Yeah, for sure. Like, there's a couple of moments in there where I was like, well, thank God this is all in one place.
Yeah, if you had to read it in installments over months, it could be frustrating, maybe.
For sure. No, it's a really fun read.
Well, we have a lot of fun news to recap this week. We recap the biggest news of the week. That means Nathan and I, we get into our lab and we test out the news, see if it can hold up to certain beakers and tubage, you know, science terms.
Tubage, yeah, man.
And starting with the biggest news of the week, Deadpool number one and new ongoing is going to be, it was announced this week for November, and Alyssa Wong and Martin Cocolo will be headlining that new run.
Yeah.
It has been a minute since we had a Deadpool series, an ongoing one.
Which seems like a crazy thing to say, right? Because wasn't it like 2 or 3 years ago, there were as many Deadpool books on the shelf as Batman books?
When Ryan Reynolds was playing the character, it was like Deadpool was in every book.
Yeah, for sure. I'm really looking forward to this. Don't know a whole lot about it other than the elevator pitch is that he has 48 hours to kill one of the world's most famous supervillains. But something weird is growing inside of him.
Right, and he's been kidnapped too. It's a lot going on there. A lot of people on Twitter, I was seeing, this blew up on the AIPT's Twitter, and like a lot of people are very excited for Wong. Wong's Dr. Aphra series has been excellent.
So good.
Great manic energy. I was actually was reviewing, I think it was one of the latest volumes that came out this week. And as I was writing, I was like, this character's so manic and high energy and fun. Like, it just suits the fact that Wong could do a Deadpool book.
And we're already getting a sense of the style of humor from this cover, which has Deadpool literally floating in a pool full of dead guys.
Right. And what does the word balloon say?
Literal enough for you.
Oh, my God. Should be fun.
Joke. It's a classic joke.
Comics need more comedy for sure. So if I'm hoping this book will be funny because Spider-Man has not been funny of late. And somebody's got to get me the ha-has. You know what I'm talking about?
Sure, sure. Yeah, for sure. Well, and like you said, Dr. Aphra is a very funny book, actually. The quipping in that series is so great.
But what's not funny, on the opposite of funny, on the spectrum of funny and not funny, Murder World Avengers
Murder
was announced.
World.
Jim Zub and Ray Fox are teaming up to write. Jethro Morales is writing the first issue. I believe it's going to be a rotating set of artists.
Yeah.
Murder World, aka Arcade, right? He's involved.
Yeah, that's Arcade's usual place where he sends people.
Yeah. A lot of people were very excited for this too. In fact, this got thousands of views on AIPTcomics.com, mm-hmm. and I didn't know why. No offense.
It's such a wild title too, Murder World Avengers.
Yeah.
But I do like this idea that it seems like they're playing up the idea that Arcade has become sort of an urban legend. People don't quite know about him. And our audience surrogate is a documentarian who is trying to uncover the truth about this secret tournament where people are sent to die.
And his name is Paul Pastor.
Yeah.
There's got to be something up with this guy if he's got one of those alliterative names.
Sure. It's a really fun concept. I'm wondering how, you know, the artwork will reflect that, the documentary style. But
that'd be interesting.
I really dig Jethro Morales' style, and I love this cover by Paco Medina. Like, this is already hitting a bunch of my buttons because I'm a sucker for an Arcade story also.
I saw someone on Twitter, they were like, why hasn't anyone just killed Arcade yet? Like Wolverine or Punisher?
Well, I think both of those guys have done that and it hasn't stuck.
Or he's like a robot or something, right?
Sure. Like there's been a couple of weird retcons with Arcade over the years.
I feel like Arcade and Dr. Doom should have a fight if they haven't already.
I'm here for it.
Yeah, I'm also here for Thanos, Death Notes number one, a one-shot anthology that's celebrating Thanos and also his origins. They're going to be going into his backstory here. We've got Ron Lim, J. Michael Straczynski, Torin Grönbeck, Kyle Starks, Christopher Cantwell, Andrea DeVito, Travel Foreman. Literally any of those names could have gotten you excited, but imagine them all on one book.
Yeah. And it's, it spins out of the current, the Eternal series and Donny Cates' Thor run and basically explores the history of Thanos. And I got to say, when I saw this title, I thought we were getting another comic book anime crossover.
Just could you
Thanos
imagine?
And Light Yagami.
Wait a minute, hold on.
Around the cosmos.
If Thanos got a hold of the... so if you don't know, Death Note is a really good manga that ended up becoming an anime where a kid gets a notebook from a god who, if he just writes their name, they die. But then he learns...
He writes everyone. He just writes everyone on a page.
How would he do that? He'd have to get, like, a printer system or something.
He writes 50%.
Now I want to see, like, a comic strip of Thanos getting the Death Note, and he's like, oh, God, this is going to take years.
No, I mean, that seems like it would work out perfectly for him, but that's not what we're getting here. This is really cool, and I love the Andrea Sorrentino cover art.
It's very cool, yeah. There's also some teaser language in here that it's kind of connected to Donny Cates' Thor in that if you remember, there was a big splash of Thanos with Mjolnir with the Infinity Stones in it. There was Marvel zombies running around behind him. Mm-hmm. This was like a year or two ago that it was teased. Yeah. So it looks like maybe we're going to get that sooner than later because this is sort of, you know, delving in that world a little bit. But I wouldn't know. I'm not Donny Cates.
Thor's going to find out if he can stop Thanos or if, you know, Thanos has been on a, you know, collision course for that future that we've seen all along.
Right. Yeah, it'll be wild if they actually pull the Marvel Zombies universe into whatever's going on in the future. Because it was always like so separated, you know?
Right.
Not separated, though, was Planet Hulk. Greg Pak is joining forces with Manuel Garcia to tell a story set 1,000 years into the future of the Planet Hulk story. It's called Planet Hulk Worldbreaker. It's a 5-issue limited series. I mean, Planet Hulk, huge success. One of the best events, in my opinion.
I revisited it within the last year
or so.
Oh, did
you? What'd you think?
Yeah, because I love Greg Pak's Hercules run.
Yeah.
And a lot of Planet Hulk was collected in those Hercules complete collections, those epic collections from Marvel.
Yeah.
If you don't have them, they're like $28 each. They're an amazing value.
Nice.
But yeah, I'm excited to revisit the world of Planet Hulk. And again, we've been talking a lot about how these big announcements from Marvel recently seem to be playing into a type of synergy with the cinematic universe. And all those rumors of a Planet Hulk miniseries a live action miniseries seem to be coming closer to being true.
And we're going to get Hulk in the She-Hulk movie, show. So maybe there's some connections there.
Yeah, but this teaser art's pretty great. Those giant sentinels in the background are pretty wild.
Yeah. So the solicit talks about a young woman with green skin who's searching for the legendary Green Scar to help save her brother from a group of apocalyptic cultists. But so this girl must be somehow related to Hulk, right?
It would seem so, and it looks like Amadeus Cho is going to factor into the story in some way. So, yep. I mean, this is very much a far-flung sequel to that classic storyline.
More Planet Hulk, please.
Yeah, absolutely.
Speaking of more green, I can't wait for DC Comics' second six-issue story arc for Poison Ivy to kick off. I think it's in January that it's kicking off. But it was announced this week that they're extending G. Willow Wilson's run. It was originally planned just a one-story arc, six-issue run.
Yeah, incredible series. So glad that there's more to say and that it's going to keep going.
And the cover art is insane.
Every single cover is a banger, right?
Like, there's these artists taking Poison Ivy and, like, just turning her into, like, these anime dreams come true, you know? It's really neat.
Man. And I like
Dan Panosian's cover is gorgeous as well.
That one's great. I love all of Josh Middleton's covers are unbelievable. I'm just so happy that this series is going.
We know you're only listening, though, so if you go to aptcomics.com, you can see all that cover art.
Sure.
Per usual. How many times I gotta say it, guys? Come on. While you're listening, you should have aiptcomics.com open.
Right, of course.
No, I'm just kidding. But you should join our patron if you haven't yet. There's some cool perks in there. Like, I mail you graphic novels that I get.
That's true.
I've got
some coming in the mail right now.
You
I'm
do.
Very excited.
They're next to me, but they're also in the mail at the same time. It's amazing. It's the future.
It is.
In other Batman news... DC Comics signaled the end of Chip Zdarsky and Jorge Jimenez's first story arc of Batman.
Yeah.
I was when I was writing this news, I was like, how can I phrase this so it sounds like Batman's ending? And then I was like, that's mean. I'm not going to do
right,
that.
Right,
right. The story arc's called Failsafe. If you haven't been reading, there's two issues now out for the Failsafe story arc, which involves a robotic Batman-looking thing that's beating the crap out of Batman and his friends.
Yeah. And it's fascinating because the idea is that this was his backup, but he also has another backup, which is the Batman of Zur-En-Arr.
Right.
So we're seeing those two things going up against each other. And the fact that we're going to be getting Zur-En-Arr backup stories in this is so exciting.
Very cool. It's a character that could definitely get more... You know, more stories, more shed a light more on it and stuff like that.
I think it is something that works best in short bursts. Like if this was something that Batman did all the time, we wouldn't have had the reaction that we had on that, you know, those last pages last month.
Yeah, true.
But I am excited to get a little bit more backstory here.
The solicit for at least Batman 129, the penultimate issue, suggests that they're going off Earth to defeat Failsafe.
And that Failsafe has already beaten the Justice League.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
I guess
this is the first arc. Like,
I know.
They came out swinging.
I know, right? That's just, And just from the very start, the way Zdarsky's writing Bruce Wayne, it's darker, in my opinion, and like...
I agree.
More morose.
Absolutely.
He's like, I don't know. It's like he's almost like bitter too about having a bat family. Like he's like annoyed by having a Robin.
I feel like he regrets bringing all these people in and changing the course of their lives like this.
Speaking of changing lives, Superman's coming back in Superman Kal-El Returns, a new Crisis tie-in coming out later this year. Mark Wade is writing it, along with Sina Grace, Alex Segura, and Marv Wolfman. What? Yeah. I know that name. and a bunch of artists, too. So obviously it's an anthology issue, special extra-sized issue, with Max Rayner on art, Dean Haspiel, Jack Herbert, another name that you might know, and Clayton Henry. Should be fun. 48 pages of delights. I'm sure there's going to be a story in there where John and Clark get back together.
Of course, but it's Clark reuniting with all of his best friends and worst enemies
after his despicable. I don't know if despicable is really hard life on Warworld.
Yeah, for sure. And I gotta say, this Dan Mora cover is just it's another classic. Like
so
the guy
good.
Doesn't miss.
Look at the Earth. Look
at
it.
Look at that planet.
I think that's an actual
it looks
photograph.
So safe.
Oh, and now it does with Superman flying around it. DC Comics also announced John Stewart, The Emerald Knight, number one, another one-shot, 48 yeah. pages. This one's written by Jeffrey Thorne with art by Marco Santucci. Yeah, John Stewart's story. He's been building up towards this in his Green Lantern run, that's for sure.
Yeah, and it's John Stewart against a mad new god trying to bring his fellow lanterns home.
Yeah.
You know, just sounds like it's going to be all-out action. The artwork for this is unbelievable.
Mm, yeah, really detailed. Really cool.
So, yeah, I'm really excited for this. I'm always big on when the intersect between Green Lantern stories and, like, high fantasy comes in. Like, it just feels like it's really made for this. And John Stewart, in particular, is a guy who is just built to survive.
We're just coming off that World Without a Justice League one-shot, yeah. And he
was so good.
He's basically a god in that, too, right? Yeah. It's pretty Guardian. Cool. The visuals on that were really cool.
That was Fernanda very Blanco, close to being in my top two this week.
Very cool main story, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on to some other comics release news. Behold Behemoth was announced, actually exclusively on AIPT. This one's by Tate Bromble and Nick Robles. Nick Robles, I love his art so much from Same. The Dreaming Waking Hours, especially. This is going to be really cool. It's a trippy kind of monster story.
Mm-hmm.
It's an original horror series about a man's fractured world and monstrous nightmares foreshadow the unthinkable. What would that be about?
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, it seems like we're dealing with, I mean, a very Waking Hours kind of idea. Dreams becoming reality and the end times being tied to nightmares. I got really excited by Tate Brumble's, like, very enthusiastic press release pitch.
Yeah.
It is psycho horror meets post-apocalypse by way of biblical fantasia. I can imagine Matt Berry saying that.
Oh, my God.
Biblical fantasia.
Oh my God, that's perfect.
But yeah, no, it just made me really happy. This looks very intriguing.
Tate's been doing some books for Jeff Lemire's Substack
in
the
right.
Black Hammer universe, and it's pretty cool that we've got not only Andrea Sorrentino, who's also very heavily tied to Jeff Lemire, but Jeff Lemire did a cover, which is really cool. You don't often see that.
And some of this interior art's giving me real, like, Books of Magic vibes.
It's interesting, right? The textures and the layering of color. It's almost like a photo that's been, I don't know, rendered wrong or something.
Do we know who the letterer is on this? Because no. Oh, Ann World, just says Ann World Design.
Oh, is okay. it? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Cool.
I mean, this looks fantastic.
And some kind of related to Boom in a way, Vault Comics is launching a bunch of Kickstarter projects starting next week. I mentioned Boom because Boom has been doing Kickstarter in the last couple of years, like with Berserker and Power Rangers and Irredeemable of late, and had huge success with it. So it's interesting to see Vault getting into the game.
Sure.
Basically, you know, to back a comic, get the money up front, essentially, and then make the comic so it's less of a risk to put out new books.
Sure.
We don't have any new information about, like, what the books will
be. What the books are, yeah.
But we do know that they're teaming up with Jaslyn Stone, who's... a guru in marketing, so kind of neat that they've tied themselves to someone who knows what they're doing in this realm, so that maybe they'll be highly successful, which is great because Vault is still relatively small publisher.
Yeah, and I like what Jaslyn said here. I know there's an audience for deluxe as hell collected comics editions thick enough to use as a weapon. You're right.
There you go. Yeah, or as heavy as one, right?
Think deluxe, think thick, which is also what my back tattoo says.
That's funny. Is it on your lower back?
No, it's a mural, actually.
Oh, shit. Wow. Yeah. Well, all in on that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's funny. Vault, I always think of Vault as a smaller publisher.
Sure.
Much smaller than Valiant, but it was revealed this week that Valiant Comics is going to strip down to one book per month.
Yeah.
This is also... behind, you know, just on trailing other news last week where we found out a couple people were let go. At least that was the rumor that was being reported.
Yeah, it seems that they are staying on. The folks that, like, Fred Pierce and Lisa Hawkins, who we thought had left the company, I guess they've worked things out, or, you know, the things were misinterpreted. But, yeah, it seems that they are staying on. But, yeah, it seems they are significantly scaling back. And unfortunately, Archer and Armstrong Forever is being canceled with the fourth issue.
And Steve Fox took to Twitter and basically said they were planning six, and then they were told, and actually he said also that they were ahead of schedule on creating the book. So that means there's at least one book that's probably almost done that's never going to see the light of day. So now they have to wrap everything up in just four issues, which is a very short run for a story arc.
Well, and then we're also, like, we've got Book of Shadows launching this month, correct?
I think they're moving it. They're delaying it.
Okay.
It's now January.
Gotcha.
Yeah. But you're right. It was supposed to come out. I mean, you wrote a review for it.
Yeah. Book of Shadows number one. Yeah, the Book of Shadows number one is out. Wait, hang on. Let me make sure. Sorry, we can cut this.
That's right.
It's just very confusing. Book of Shadows, number one, Valiant. There's the website.
Oh, yeah, you're right. July 27th.
Yeah. So, Book of Shadows just launched with its first issue.
Right.
And then they're going to wrap up Archer and Armstrong Forever with issue four. Then they're running the new Bloodshot series, which is a four-issue miniseries for 4 months. And then Book of Shadows comes back with number two all the way in January.
That's crazy.
It's tough. that doesn't look good. I'm not saying that they're not doing the best thing for their employees by cutting things back, but I hope that's not their usual model from here on out, because having your big crossover releasing one issue every 6 months is
not good.
I mean, that's some Image United shit.
What's crazy too, like, how is that sustainable to put out one book a month?
I can't imagine it is.
They must have lost investors or something. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, it's hard to speculate, but it doesn't feel good, right? Like, and Valiant is a publisher that I very much like. I mean, we were expecting Ninjak to come back before the end of the year as well. So I guess that's not happening now, or has been pushed back further.
What about Liam Sharp drawing Exo Manowar?
Oh my God. Yeah. All these books that were announced.
Yeah.
Shadow Man is on hiatus again.
Yep.
Wow. That's not great.
What's crazy too is, do you remember, I think it was last year they did Year of Valiant. And then they pushed it to this year, and now look what happened.
Right.
I'm laughing out of, like, oh my God, this is insane.
How much of this is Vin Diesel's fault, do you think?
Oh my God, he definitely... Well, before that movie came out, whoever owns Valiant was like, we're going to do a whole movie universe, it's going to be huge. And unfortunately, Bloodshot had to come out during a pandemic, on top of probably being an okay movie.
Bloodshot, for a minute there, I thought Bloodshot was going to be the last movie. Like, I swear, I was like, if Bloodshot and Sonic the Hedgehog are the last movies.
Yeah. What a world. What's crazy, remember when Bloodshot came out and it was like the number one movie, but it only made like $100,000 or something?
Yeah.
And they were bragging about it. No, I never saw it.
It's real bad, but I bet. It's a bummer. But I hope, you know, for the sake of the folks who are working for Valiant, doing really great work that's sometimes underappreciated by a lot of the comic book buying audience. I hope that this works out in the long run. But it seems really bleak.
It does. Yeah, it's not a good sign. Well, we'll take a temperature test next summer and see what happens. Where they are then.
For sure.
Moving on to our temperature test of the episode, our top books of the week. We're going to give our temperatures on our top two favorite comics. The hotter, the better.
Uh-huh. You had something pretty hot for your number two book, right?
I just say nonsense on this show sometimes. My second favorite book of the week was Predator Number One by Ed Brisson and Kev Walker. Another book that was delayed a billion years and is finally here.
Worth the wait, Dave.
It really was. It really was. It's funny to think this book was sitting on shelves, probably in boxes anyway, already printed for the last year, but it's finally seen the light of day, right in time for Prey, the great film that came out last week. And I think it actually crushed Sandman for number one most watched thing on streaming.
Man, Prey is unbelievable. I mean, there's not an ounce of fat on that movie, you know? Like, that movie is, like, 95 minutes with credits, and I forgot that we could make movies like that.
Wait, it's not 3 hours long? I don't have to pee four times?
It's so good. maybe controversial statement, best of the Predator series.
Oh my god. If you don't agree with Nathan, please write a review. Positive review. We'll only look at the positive ones. But then tell him
and
that
he's
wrong. And
let it be known that like the only ones that I actively dislike are the Alien vs. Predator movies and The Predator from a few years ago.
Yeah, they're problematic films. Not like this comic, though.
This does something totally new with,
it opens
with the property.
A couple years in the future, 2056, which
sure.
To me is hard to believe that we'd have space travel that soon, but you never know. and yeah,
it feels
so
pretty in line with the Alien franchise, though, right?
Oh, you're right. They're probably trying to align them both. They own them both now. So this book is about a young girl who loses mm-hmm. her parents. We learn that fairly early on in the story.
Yeah.
And a predator starts taking them out, taking out the parents, taking out the mm-hmm. community she lives in, that they live in the spaceship. They're doing like research. At least we think they're doing research and they're not doing anything too terrible. But
sure,
seems
like it's okay. Yeah.
Soon, though, we cut to the present and she's grown up a little bit and she's hunting the shit out of predators.
She's killed like 15 of them across the galaxy.
Brisson does a fantastic job not only categorizing her, but setting up this AI ship identity that she has clearly only been with for quite so many years. And she's a badass right out of the gate, and mm-hmm. it's not a tell and don't show. It's a show. Like, her, for instance, the AI keeps telling her, you need food, dude. Get food. Yeah. Get food. And she doesn't care.
We're getting exposition during action. We're getting characterization, you know, through carrying out action. Yeah, absolutely. It's a perfectly paced first issue.
And there's a lot of promise for growth in the Predator universe. I don't think we know much about Predators.
Not really. Most of the backstory we have on these come from either, you know, comics that are now, you know, relegated to non-canon status.
Right.
Or, you know, stuff that the creators have said outside of the movies.
Right.
I also, one of the things that I really loved was the data page that opens the book basically tells us, hey, all of these movies are canon. Here's a quick rundown of what happened in each Predator movie. Mm-hmm. And now let's jump 50 years into the future.
Which is really, it's kind of funny because like Prey is going way far in the past and now we're going into the future.
Yeah.
But it makes sense. Like humans are now developed enough where they could maybe even compete or fight with predators mm-hmm. in space.
Well, there was this great thing Phil Nobile Jr. From Fangoria pointed out on Twitter. Like, all of the Predator movies have been preoccupied with showing them fighting modern day people and technology.
Yeah.
And this new movie kind of opens the floodgates for, why don't we get a Predator movie in feudal Japan? Why don't we get a Wild West Predator movie? Mm-hmm. And then this one is like, well, why don't we show how we're going to keep getting better at fighting these things?
Right. There's some hints that there's some kind of culture going on with how the predators hunt on certain planets, how they have like a routine or schedule of hunting.
And they'll take over for one if one of them falls.
Yeah, it's very fascinating, and we've only just started.
Which was kind of hinted at in the old Batman versus Predator comics.
Oh, like such a good comic.
The sequel was like, oh, you killed that one, so now it's like a badge of honor if someone, if a young predator can take out the Batman.
Yeah. That was a cool ending.
Yeah.
Did you see the tweet about they should make a movie called Prey, P-R-A-Y, and it's Predator Fighting Jesus?
No, I didn't see
and
that.
And the Apostles?
They should do Eat, Pray, Love.
Oh my god. With an E, though. Prey.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. Very cool. Yeah, I was... You know, it's leading up to Predator coming out, a lot of creators who had been able to read this early because they're friends with Ed Brisson
were
just glowing over it. And I think they're right.
Yeah.
There's a lot of promise here. Obviously, things could turn around with second issue, like mm-hmm. with any series, but I'm very on board for this.
Yeah, I'm so happy for this team. Like you said, this book's been sitting on a shelf for over a year now.
Yeah.
And it's just great to see it out here. And it's one that hasn't had to be... You know, so often when we see a book get delayed like that, they either get completely overhauled to try to fit in with continuity or they get shelved, you know, permanently because now they don't have a place. And since this is very much its own thing, I feel like we still got to see what they intended with this book.
Yeah, and another thing to your point is, like, they're taking some big swings here. This isn't just, like, another big muscle man fighting Predator.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. It almost feels like the timing worked out perfectly for this to come out on the heels of Prey.
Mm, yeah, that's true. Good point. Thank you. Although, I want you to make an even better point for your second pick of the week.
Man, my second favorite book of the week was I Am Batman.
Number 12, you're not. You're Nathan.
By John Ridley and Christian Deuce. Or...
I'm sorry. Terrible trip.
I am Batman. This book continues to surprise me in the way that it threads superhero action and modern day social concerns and politics. It also thrilled me to no end to have Renee Montoya as the Question in this book. One of my favorite characters of all time, and just really great to have her show up fully formed and, you know, have a history with the Batman. And this book really plays with questions of legacy and how, you know, she's not much like Jace Fox is not the first Batman. Mm-hmm. She's not the first Question. Mm. And so they have to realize, you know, they're kind of testing each other, and you learn that Renee's approach to fighting crime is less about throwing punches and more about holding up a mirror and asking people to really interrogate themselves about, you know, why they do the things they do, because she realizes that so much of the violence that she faces is systemic, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just it's a really smart, really beautiful book. My one knock on it is, I think, something you've mentioned in your reviews
of
this series, is that occasionally it feels like we lose some of the momentum when we stop to check in on the rest of the cast.
Yeah.
You know, so there are some subplots that don't necessarily feel like they're forwarding the story, although they are forwarding character development. So maybe, you know, in a few issues I'll be like, wow, I'm really glad I had this scene of, you know, Tiff at school, you know?
Right, right.
But at the moment, I'm just like, man, I really want to find out who killed Anarchy, you know?
that was something I was thinking when I was reading this issue.
Yeah. But it's a really great book, and I love how it continues to pull in real world issues and concerns into this larger cape and cowl mystery.
Yeah, I mean, it's set in New York City, so it's like a little more grounded in a sense, just with that,
for
too,
sure.
Right?
To the point where, like, the police commissioner at one point says, you know, I didn't have any fucking masks in my city until, like, a month ago, and now there's two of you.
Yeah.
And so it almost becomes a challenge to Jace to make sure that he's not inviting the wrong crowd to New York City.
Right, 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 right. Yeah, when the book started, I was, like, very on board for, like, wow, what's it going to be like for Jace to be a protector of a city and be, you know, and establish himself? And that's sort of been going on, but it's, like for instance, his, like, secret hideout base.
Right.
That's been slowly developing in the background, but it's almost, because there's so many side characters, Jace has sort of fallen back a little bit, and he's not even, it's much more of an ensemble, and I don't think it started that way, which is one of the things where I'm just like, I want it back, but if it wants to change, it wants to change.
Yeah, I mean, I had the same feeling, and now I'm sort of beginning to realize, like, so much of those early issues of I Am Batman is about how alone he is.
Yeah.
And I think so much of, somehow, moving to a new town has made him realize, and maybe this is because it's something I've sort of been through, is moving to a new area and realizing those connections that you still have are so important. And
interesting.
So, I think he's learning to trust and trying to figure out who he can trust. So that's an interesting dynamic to see with Jace, who, you know, from the get-go has been absolutely no one is on my side and I don't care.
Right, right. Yeah, that's tough. And he might have more money than Bruce Wayne now.
That's true. That's very true.
Apparently Bruce Wayne's very poor. Nice, dude. My favorite book of the week was Axe Judgment Day number 2. Mm-hmm. Or do you call it AXE Judgment Day number 2?
Ashay.
By Kieran Gillen and Valerio Sheedy. This is obviously the second issue of Marvel's big summer book, which ties into lots of other books, including mostly X-Men books right now.
Mm-hmm.
I loved this issue. I was one of the, if you look at comicbookroundup.com, I was one of the lower reviews on issue 1.
Uh-huh.
But then I think it was one of the highest, if not the highest, review on issue two. So maybe I just don't know how good.
No, you texted me like as soon as you finished reading it. Yeah. You were like, okay, I get what this is now.
Yes. So this issue, I think, is a really good example of how you make event comics feel big, high stakes, but also connected and grounded to a smaller story. It opens with six human beings, normal people across the world, London, Vancouver, Mumbai, New York, etc.
Aruba, Jamaica.
And there are these captions that are, they look a bit like the machine that's in the earth, or that is the earth, but they're actually pink, and they're talking about each character, and each one has a different life. Some of them are very familiar. They're like people who just tweet all day. There's other people who have parents that are having their own problems. There's a et cetera, et cetera. So there's this grounded, like, these are human beings, real people, and this is their take on a cataclysmic, potentially earth-shattering event, but a lot of them are so used to these big events on Earth that a lot of them aren't phased. Some of them hate the X-Men and blame them. Some of them blame the Eternals. So you're getting this, like, real-world, on-the-ground perspective. And then the next page is a smash cut to Exodus and Jean Grey fighting, you know, a 70-story tall Celestial.
Yeah.
So it's just like a breakneck thing. There are basically three layers to this book where we've got characters fighting a Celestial on Krakoa who's trying to destroy Krakoa. We've got these humans that we check in on. And then we've got a bunch of characters, including a bunch of the Avengers, trying to bring Avengers Mountain back to life. The Celestial that's been long dead. I think it's been dead for like millennia even.
Well, and what's so fun about it is that, like you said, it works on its own perfectly well, but then when you're reading the books that are spinning out of this, it does really enrich it. Like that sequence with Exodus, having read the last issue of Immortal X-Men, I'm just like, good for you, man.
yeah. No, you're right. It also the X-Men Red, where we just found out a bunch of mutants were just murdered by the Eternals. And there's a big hook at the end of this issue, too, where it could potentially become a big fight, kick-punching book into something far more philosophical, psychological? I don't know.
Yeah.
It's just really well. And Valerio Schiti, man. When I was reviewing Empire, like, his ability to draw, you know, 12 characters in a single panel and they all look badass and well-framed. Like,
I think he's going to become the go-to for events like this, like for a while. Like absolutely.
And then that with Marte Gracia's colors, and the book just looks super bright and like fun, but also dramatic. And I just can't believe how much is going on and it still makes sense. It's, it's really good. I'm really hoping it continues to be as good as issue two, because this could be an all-timer event if it's that good.
Nice, man.
We really want to know what your favorite book of the week is.
My favorite book of the week was Love Everlasting, number one, by Tom King and Elsa Chartier. I read this a little while back, but I, you know, was happy to revisit it.
Because it's a Substack comic anyone could read for free.
Absolutely. And I feel like reading it in a physical edition still hits different. You know what I mean? Like it's nice to be able to, and I think part of that is the old school vibe of this. Like what's so interesting about this book is it reads exactly like a classic romance book, romance comic for like the first like 15 pages. I mean, it really takes a minute. Like for the first chunk of the book, I feel like most people are going to be like, is this what this is? You know what I mean? Like, is that it? Is that what, like these two got together to do like a hokey throwback, but it becomes so much more. This character is trapped in a never-ending cycle of different loves and romances, and she's having trouble keeping track of who she is and where she is and what time she's in. And it's just it's so weird. We don't have any answers so far, but there's just there is a combination of sweetness and meanness to the story that just really knocked me off my feet.
Yeah. This was very close to being my second favorite book of the week.
It's fantastic.
The art is so good.
Chartier, like, she doesn't miss. Like, and like, the colors just pop out of every page. I mean, it really does. Oh, hang on. That was weird. There was a really loud hip hop pop-up ad on Image's website.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, the colors just pop on every page. It really feels like a classic romance comic in terms of aesthetic, and even in just like the very boldly declarative dialogue. It's a book that revels in its tropes and makes you completely buy into its aesthetic until it totally flips the script on you.
There's a moment where the main character like looks right at us and she's like, "What?" Basically.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Great. There's a when she looks into the mirror and says, "Fuck." Like it's just it's the best. Like this, or it's it's an exceptional first issue that gives me just enough questions to want to keep going.
The captions are interesting too, the way they're like these sort of circles that are like populated in the same way. Yeah, Elsa's such a cartoonist, so good.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've been looking forward to more people getting to read this, and it's been really nice to see that the overall reception has been so positive.
Tyler West at AIPT gave it a 10 out of 10, and it's a great review. You should
check
it out.
It's a really good review. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You're convincing me. Should it be my second favorite book of the week? It's too late, David.
I felt the same way when you were talking about Predator. I was like, shit, that is a good book.
We'll just swap it.
It was a good week for comics.
It was, yeah. There was a lot of good stuff to read. In fact, we have more to talk about as far as good to read.
Yeah.
In our standout.
Kapow!
Moment of the week. Yeah, I think I do that the same way every time. Yeah.
This was such a good week for comics that I didn't remember until like yesterday that there was a new Deceased book.
I know, one of the most popular comic series ever, maybe. It's breaking records. Yeah,
for sure. And I really have enjoyed Deceased quite a bit, and so it was like a second surprise to learn that it was back.
Yeah, it's been a minute. It's maybe a whole year since the last or maybe
something
more actually.
Like that.
Because there was that like tie-in sort of Deceased that wasn't technically, cuz this is the third part of the trilogy,
yeah.
Right? The third.
There's been
Deceased.
A couple of different like spin-off series. There was one with like Red Arrow or Red Hood, and there was the one that was it Hope at World's End that followed Jimmy Olsen, and yeah, there's been a couple of different offshoots of the series, but yeah, this is the definitive final chapter. Begins with War of the Undead Gods.
It'd be hilarious if your Kapow wasn't Deceased and you were just talking about Deceased.
By the way, did you know about Deceased? Yeah, my standout moment this week came from Deceased War of the Undead Gods number one. This book opens with Supergirl Kara Zor-El being sent away by her parents ahead of a cataclysm and being told that she's being sent to the planet of the New Gods, New Genesis, where they will be able to raise her properly and take care of her benevolent gods devoted to peace. Of course, when she lands, she finds that they've all been turned into zombies by the anti-life equation. And just the listening to her parents' final message as the gods close in on her and grab her. The caption from her father says, "The future is the greatest gift we could give you." And we see her being just overrun by the zombies. It's a brutal, upsetting sequence of events. It literally gave me chills when I read this opening sequence. And I think it might be the hardest hitting moment of the book.
The hurrah that she screams. Yeah. It's so cool. The lettering, they've got like little like explosions going on in each letter. It's neat.
Yeah.
Really cool. Well, not cool for her. That sucks. But
sure.
My favorite moment of the week comes from Ghost Rider Vengeance Forever number one by Benjamin Percy and Juan Jose Rip. Really liked this issue. This is another book that I really loved.
Fun.
It's a special to celebrate Ghost Riders of all eras. And there is a Johnny Blaze goes to get a tattoo.
Yeah.
From a guy named Necro the Tattooist. And
that's who did my back tattoo.
Oh shit, dude, really? That's awesome. You know that tattoo was already there before he did it?
No.
Yeah, he just lifted it up through the skin, which he tells him. Anyway, one of the first, basically he uses, these tattoos are literally events that have happened in the past and the future.
Yeah.
one of which, one of the first ones, is a Western set in Texas in the 1800s. There's a couple really good full-page splashes in this, but this one, super cool. We've got the Ghost Rider riding a flaming horse. Mephisto is in the moon laughing. I guess they're robbing a stagecoach? Is that what they call it? Stagecoach? Yeah. But the horse looks great, and there's so much detail. Again, go to apgcomics.com, go to this podcast, post, see it. But detailing in the chains, the flames.
It feels dusty.
Yeah, the ground is getting kicked up.
Yeah.
And the flame coming out of the head is kind of interesting. It's going off to the side as if to convey there's some movement of the guy on the back of the horse.
Mm-hmm.
This book, I can't believe we keep saying this on the show, and I think to each other, like, how is Ben Percy getting away with some of the gore in this series?
It's wild. Yeah, for sure.
Marvel usually is like, no, it's for kids. Thank God they're not anymore. In our next segment, Top Books for Next Week, we're going to talk about our most anticipated comic out next week.
Mm-hmm.
I am looking forward to Batman One Bad Day, The Riddler, number one by Tom King and Mitch Gerads. This one is part of a series of extra-size one-shots, regular-size one-shots. There'll be one every month from now till, I think, February. And Riddler is the first one up by one of the most famous Batman creative teams in the last 10 years, I'd say, right?
Oh, yeah. And then they've been hyping this book up for, like, months, it feels like, at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, so excited about it.
Mitch's art is so freaking good. It's, like, hyper-realistic and moody, mm-hmm. and you're gonna get a heck of a lot of nine-panel grids.
Right.
Well, a funny little side thing about this... AIPT tweeted the preview for this, and apparently there was an error in the DC's preview. A bunch of the text was like letters and symbols.
Oh, so everyone's like, the Riddler.
Well, that's funny. Mitch Gerads was like, oh my God, I blame this on Doc Shaner. And then like all these people were piling on, and then I got sent corrected pages and I updated it. It was just a funny moment on Friday.
That's really funny.
And actually a bunch of people, including Tim Sheridan, mm-hmm. was like, ah, bummer. I was really excited to read a book where there was, like, dialogue that didn't make any sense. and they're not wrong, because there's, like, this weird guy saying
stuff. That is funny.
It's kind of neat.
That's clever.
But what are you anticipating?
I'm really excited about Barbaric Axe to Grind, number one, by Michael Moreci and Nathan Gooden. This is the return of Barbaric after when we had a... one shot that kind of bridged the gap here and built out the world a little bit. Mm-hmm. And this one brings us back to right where the first miniseries, the first chapter left off with Owen Axe and the gang going up against a bunch of vampires. And then they have to investigate an enemy from Owen's past. I don't know a whole bunch about the story beyond that. I've avoided reading it up until now.
Yeah.
But I am really, really excited to get back into this bizarre, hilarious, hyper-violent fantasy world.
I mean, you can't beat a talking axe.
No, absolutely.
I got to read this a couple of weeks ago because there was an interview on AIPT with Moreci and Gooden. And It, if you like fantasy and you like certain tropes of fantasy, you know, like mermaids, say, I'm not saying there is one in this, but they really know how to like bring in some familiar looking beasties that are told in a different way or in a comedic way.
I have heard that, like, although the cliffhanger of book one was vampires, that gets taken care of pretty quickly.
There is a lot of vampires in the very beginning that may not be showing up later.
Yeah. I love that, actually.
They just didn't get a memo and didn't come for the second half. There's no violence.
That's funny.
I don't think that. No.
Not in
and
this book.
In our next segment, judging by the cover, Junior, we're going to talk about our favorite cover. And oh my God, it's a Stoko weekend.
Stoko. It sure is. Totally unplanned.
If you like James Stokoe, you'll love this segment as we talk about our favorite cover art out next week. My favorite cover was by James Stokoe for X-Men 13, which was actually solicited a year ago or more.
And I almost think maybe I might have picked this a year ago.
I think you might have.
That feels so familiar. But yeah, when we were going to get all those Predator variants.
Yeah, they've got a different variant. It was planned for a whole month of Predator variants. And we've got We've got Cyclops, Jean Grey, Archangel, Beast, I think that's all the X-Men here, fighting a whole lot of Predators in hyper stoko detail with some great coloring. Just, oh my God, it's so cool. Yours is also fighting alien. Well, no, they're vampires, are they?
Yeah. I too chose a James Stokoe variant for DC versus Vampires All Out War number 2. We've got Mary Marvel and Booster Gold standing amidst a sea of dead / feasting / maybe hibernating vampires. But the real great thing here is that Booster Gold looks like he's seen some shit. He's mm-hmm. covered in goo. He's got a necklace of vampire fangs, and he's holding 2 stakes, and he just is kind of staring into the middle distance.
Maybe he's looking for an oven to cook those steaks. I'm so sorry.
No, don't ever apologize for a pun in this house. I'm really looking forward to this issue. I wasn't crazy about the first issue of All Out War, but very, very curious to see how it ties into the main series, because I guess the thing about this book is it feels like the tie-ins are happening or coming out at the wrong time. Like something happened to John Constantine in the main book that we haven't seen in this one yet, and it just feels like we're missing stories. I don't know.
No, you're right, because actually the solicit for this issue is like, John Constantine does something bad.
Either way, this cover has me excited to see Booster Gold just go into town on some vampires.
That's funny if you have the wrong context for that sentence. Moving on to our last segment, Matthew Arnold joins the show to talk about Eden. It's a new book coming out from Dark Horse Physical Comic Book Shops August 30th. It's out by Comixology, Amazon, already digitally. Enjoy. On with us is Matt Arnold. Matt, you've got Eden out on Comixology. It's coming out into print via Dark Horse. Thank you so much for being on the AMPT Comics podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I've had an eventful morning already, I wanted to tell you.
Yeah.
I fished a bat out of my pool this morning.
Oh my God. It's a sign. You're going to be writing Batman soon.
That's what I was thinking. It's inspired me. The drowning of Batman. Maybe that'll be the comic.
Batman drowned.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't know these guys could swim, but there he was. But I fished him out this morning. So that's how I started my day.
So you're a rescue ranger.
Apparently, yeah.
Chip, Dale, and Matt Arnold.
Yeah. If you're imagining me like diving into the pool with like a knife in my teeth and like pulling him out of the water, that's not quite how it happened. It was I got the net. So
nice.
I didn't want to get bitten and turned to a vampire. So I had some space between me and him.
See, you're a writer, so that's just you're logging that in your brain for a future story.
Yeah. You'll see it somewhere.
Well, something people will see is Eden. They can get it on Comixology right now. It's your graphic novel with Riccardo Bertielli. It's a sci-fi story about, I would say, prisons. But what is the elevator pitch for those who may not have heard about it?
Well, in the near future, they've discovered that it's more cost-effective to cryogenically freeze prisoners instead of keep them locked in cages and pay them and feed them. Not feed them, but feed them and pay guards to watch them. So they cryogenically freeze prisoners. And the story takes place when a senator and her husband, who are accused of killing their son, suddenly witness a prison break. And so they break out of this futuristic prison and they open the gates to get out with a bunch of other prisoners. And they find a prehistoric world and they realize that they've been imprisoned for thousands of years and they might be the only ones left in society. And now their question is, do we release the rest of the prisoners in hopes of restarting it with sort of the worst of society? Can we build up from this humble beginning? So that's the story.
When I was talking about Eden with my co-host who couldn't be here today, Nathan Simmons, I was saying like, God, it reminds me of like a show like Lost where like you just keep pounding us with these surprise twists and things just keep elevating to different places, especially the ending, which we won't give away here. But you are from the realm of television. You've got Emerald City and Siberia under your belt. What was the proclivity to get into comics?
Well, you know, sort of two things converging at once. I mean, I'd always wanted to do one. I didn't really have a method by which to do it. I, you know, fell in love with comics and all the, you know, the great storytelling that can be done there. It just, it always seemed to me like this, you know, wild west of creativity that in the TV world, you're always hemmed in by so many constraints. I thought, wow, that would be so exciting. And then the pandemic hit and all my projects that were kind of on the bubble disappeared and I had nothing to do. And I thought, well, maybe this is my opportunity. So during the pandemic, I wrote Eden, and I also wrote a novel, co-wrote a novel with a buddy of mine. And I thought, well, this is sort of my chance to do some of these things that have always been things I've dreamed about, never had the time to do. And sort of it opened it up. So, you know, the passion and the opportunity kind of came together during that very strange 2020.
Yeah, when we were about a year into the pandemic, I started thinking, oh my God, we're going to get so many stories in the next, you know, 2 to 10 years that are reflective of this incredible, you know, shared tragedy. And we've interviewed a lot of people on the show, and a lot of them have talked about like, oh, well, I came up with this, you know, Batman arc or this indie comic idea because of that. It's so fascinating.
Yeah, I think we're going to see a flux of really creative stuff. I mean, from people all over, you know, from people who had, you know, just a 9-to-5 job and had creative interests that they could never do, had a chance to do them. And I hope people availed themselves of that in these periods. And I think we're going to see a lot of stuff come out in the next decade that from different voices that we hadn't heard from before. I think it's going to be really interesting to see, you know, what comes of this strange time in human history.
Did you read comics as a kid?
I did, but you know, the funny thing is I didn't really fall in love with comics until I was older. I missed some of the heyday of comics that kids my age had, that because I was too much into movies, novels, video games, and you know, my interest in Caped Crusaders came mostly from television and movies. And so I thought, well, why read about them when I can watch them? Because that's how it was wired then. And it wasn't until later that I started seeing how great it was. I really came sort of late to the comic party. And I was like, wow, well, this is what I've been missing all through like my teenage years that I should have been enjoying. And I had to have friends turn me on to comics. That's when I kind of got into it a little bit later than everybody else.
Do you remember the series that got you back into comics?
You know, it's sort of funny. I had a friend turn me on to a book called The Marquee by Guy Davis. Mm-hmm. And I saw that book and I was like, what is this thing? And I read it and I thought, wow, this is so cool. Like, look at this really neat, very different world. And that sort of launched me into going into comic book stores like all the time, you know, when I was first living here in LA. And I would just stalk through those and spend all day there, like, looking at all this great story and just eating it up and realizing, oh my God, all the great stuff I missed.
Mm. Yeah. It's like a golden age right now, especially for like horror. I mean, we're getting horror from the big two, which traditionally we're just doing superhero stories for general audiences. And now we're like, Swamp Thing is one of the scariest books on the stands. And you're like, whoa, this is, but you know, it's cyclical, right? Like we all grew up with comics, and now the people who grew up with comics our age are now making the comics. It's like,
right. And it's a great crossover. I mean, look at all the things we're doing with media between comic books and podcasting and movies and television shows. Everybody's, you know, transmedia is just this really interesting sort of crossing of storytelling. And you can tell a story in one medium and then tell corollary stories in other media that back it up and build worlds. And I just think it's such an exciting time to be a creator because you can avail yourself of all these different tools that have, you know, different benefits to them. You know, for me, when writing a graphic novel was so rewarding because being a guy used to just writing letters on a page, I was creating the frames. It was sort of like directing on the page and working with Ricardo, who was able to do things beyond my wildest estimations of what these panels would look like. But originally just thinking about the angles and the scenes that I wanted to see, the things that would come into my head as a writer that you're not supposed to say. You're not supposed to tell the director how to direct. But with the comic book, I had a chance to sort of put the vision out, and it was really, really rewarding. I thought, wow, this is such a fun medium to create in. I'll do more. I've sort of fallen in love with it.
Was it tricky going from, you know, television teleplays to writing scripts for comics?
You know, it's funny. My editor, Will Dennis, read my first draft and said, I would never have known that you'd never done this before.
Oh, wow. That's great.
And I read a bunch of comic scripts. I hadn't read comic scripts before. I read them, saw how they were formatted. But there is a little bit more of a natural translation for TV writers to comics than there would be, for instance, for novels. When I wrote my first novel, I was writing chapters really short because I'm used to describing, you know, a house, dark,
right,
cold.
Right.
Like, that's it. That's the house.
Interior, night.
Yeah, that's really hard to train my brain to make that like a page of description.
Yeah.
But with the comics, you know, I was really focusing on making sure and telling the story through the dialogue, which is something that comes naturally to TV and film writers. And then, you know, being able to describe in rather short sentences what the shots are going to look like. So it was a little bit of combining my directorial experience, because I have directed on Siberia and on my first feature. So I had a little bit of that already in my wheelhouse, and just combining that with my typical writing style. So it was more natural than I thought it was going to be. And again, like I said, just really enjoyable to get to sort of really write out those visuals and explain the angles that I'm looking at and what the panels are going to be described as. That was really fun.
It's really interesting to me. There's almost a renaissance of TV writers getting into comics. We've got Christopher Cantwell, Jeremy Adams, Tim Sheridan, all from that realm, now writing ongoing series. And I think you hit the nail on the head. Like, your brain is sort of built to write in this way that just suits the comics format. And Eden suits the comics format.
Well, thank you. Because, you know, when I was originally conceiving it, I mean, my first instinct is usually to go to, like, when I come up with an idea, is like, how is this going to be a TV show? And when I conceived Eden and I was thinking about it, I thought, it's so big, it's so visual. It's going to be hard. I got to figure out how we can convince studios to spend all this money on crazy ideas. And then the comic book realm is naturally driven toward that kind of spectacle, right? You want those big colorful pieces and those panels and prehistoric creatures and all the fun that is what Eden is. And I thought, well, this is much more natural as a comic book. So it felt like that was the correct format for it. And as I was starting to sort of filter my ideas into what format, like, there are certain things now that I'm conceiving, and I'm like, oh, that's going to be a book. I can tell already that's going to be a graphic novel. And so I'm thinking differently than I ever have before. But I think, to your point, I think that the people that are in television are also seeing that it's a chance to throw off the shackles a little bit of conventions of TV writing. And as you're thinking about TV, you're always thinking about the engine, and you're thinking about, you know, how it's going to have to pay off by this certain time frame and what it's going to cost and all these types of things. It's like, no, just throw that away and just let your brain do what it wants to do creatively and not worry about it. And you'll be rewarded in the graphic novel world, because people do want to see things that push the envelope a little bit. And I think that's what's so fun about this renaissance in graphic novels and comics right now.
Jeremy Adams was on the show a couple weeks ago, and he was saying, because he's written a bunch of DC animated movies, and there's like a rule of how many people can be in the background, because it just takes more time for the animators to draw it, and then you're like out of budget.
Right, right.
What would the budget for Eden be? Do you have any idea if it was live action?
Well, you know, it really depends. You know, there's you know, if I was translating it, there's a sense of scope that you would do, and you could go full out and have a completely prehistoric CGI background realm.
Right.
I was doing it as a show. I would more use the jungle as like. Is like the ocean in Jaws, just this constant threat whereby in the middle of the night, in the middle of a scene, you don't know when or where this just saber-toothed tiger just grabs you and rips you into the dark, screaming and kicking. And it's an instantaneous moment of horror that comes from nowhere. and that you're constantly on edge, mm-hmm. but you wouldn't necessarily have to do CGI on every frame all the time. That would blow it up. So again, if I was doing it as a show, I would probably keep it contained like that, because mm-hmm. I find that more terrifying. You know, less showing of the shark, I think, is always good for creating the tension that you want. So it wouldn't necessarily be that huge, but the fun of making it as a graphic novel was to just get to revel really in the look and the feel of this world and the idea of where they could possibly be, you know, mm-hmm. where are they is, you know, part of the question of the book. And it allowed me to plant lots of clues as to what that might actually be.
There's a lot of political unrest in the story too. Did you have this future mapped out and a Bible of all the characters and their backgrounds and stuff like that?
Yeah. Well, you know, I love stories that unpeel themselves. And my analogy, whenever I talk about good storytelling, or the storytelling that I like, I should say, is sort of like walking around a house with a flashlight. You don't see everything at once. And as you start to rove over things, you start to get the full picture. Mm-hmm. And I really like characters to unveil themselves that way as well. You know, when you meet somebody, we all have a preconceived notion after those few first 5 minutes. You know, they say you know somebody right away, but you really don't. There's so much about them that gets revealed over time. And what I like to do in the course of a television series and in a graphic novel is to sort of unpeel them. You know, you might find that your preconceived notions of somebody are wildly wrong. And that's a testament to how complex we are as human beings. And I like to discover that people are not who you think they are. That goes for storytelling as well. The world itself seems to be one thing and starts to unveil itself as something else. And I think that is just a part of the world that we're in right now. I think we're all looking at the world that we thought we knew so well, as suddenly having the rug pulled out from under us with the pandemic just made us all think that maybe things are a lot more complicated than we thought. Maybe there's different layers that we're not seeing. Maybe we've been walking through the world a little bit with these comforting blinders on, and there are other much more deeper things occurring in the world that we need to pay attention to. And I think that probably was a natural outcropping in the work. You know, artists often just subconsciously are reflecting how we're feeling. And I think that's definitely part of what's going on in the book.
That's funny how you phrase that, because it's like, write what you know. It's sort of counter to that. You don't know you know it. It's an unknown. What is that Rumsfeld quote? The unknown unknowns.
I don't know anything. I think that was the
question. Yeah, basically.
You're right, though. I think that these things sort of creep into the psyche, you know, and you don't, you know, I think being didactic in art, it always turns me off. But learning something subconsciously is a much better way to absorb, and also doesn't undermine your message, because your viewer gets to come to it themselves. So I think in those ways, when you're a writer and you're observing the world and you're writing things, you know, as long as you can avoid being preachy, I think you can explore issues that are important to you. And I think that's a lot of what the book was too, is I seem to be very interested in these questions about redemption and forgiveness and in a world that's so segregated. The show that I'm writing right now for Netflix is called Revenge Inc. So there's two polar ends of things. Should we be angry and avenge ourselves against the wrongs doings that we see, or should we be forgiving and redemptive and allow people to heal? And I think those are two different works of mine right now, where you can see me kind of trying to figure that out in this world of crazy world that we're in right now.
Yeah. That's an interesting connection there. Eden is also a story with tons of twists and turns. Were you in competition with yourself to outdo yourself with each chapter?
I love you saying that. Thank you. I think it has to do with my lack of attention. I think I need.
I'm bored. Twist.
I need something to surprise me to keep me interested in movies and stuff. So when I grab on to a great show, it's because I'm constantly surprised, and I want to be surprised. And I think that when I write, I feel like I owe that to the reader, to keep them constantly unsure of where the story is going to go. I think if you know where it's going to go, it's very easy to lose interest, even if it's really well written and even if it's great. So for me, I always have to be flipping the story upside down as many times as I can and shaking to see what comes out.
Do you prescribe to the J.J. Abrams' mystery box format?
Well, look, J.J. Abrams is like one of the great artists of our time right now. I mean, he's so fantastic at getting your attention and holding it through through so many twists and turns. And, you know, I study him. Tarantino is another artist who's constantly making you guess what you thought you knew or where you thought things were going. And I'm definitely a big fan of any kind of storytelling that can keep you surprised. That big twists, you know, like, you know, M. Night Shyamalan, like walking out of Sixth Sense the first time and realizing I've been completely fooled, just totally changed me as an artist. I said, I want to be able to be ahead of the audience. And I think that I will win them over if I can fool them, or I can misdirect them, or if they don't know where it's going, they'll be pleased rather than angry. And I thought that was a sort of a great way to tell a story.
What made Ricardo so perfect for this project?
So I'd seen Ricardo's work in DMZ, and what I noticed about his characters was that they're so real, they're so human. There's nothing about his characters that feel cookie cutter or glamorized. It's sort of the difference between like a network actor and like a gritty streaming actor, a character actor. If you look at DMZ, you will just see these like, you know, weird scrawny guys and bizarre facial hair and tattooed and, you know, one tooth missing and just these very uniquely drawn characters that I don't have in my head. And he's really able to find the faces and to find the personalities in the look based on the words. And I tried to give him very unique characters and he just took to them. I was so pleased when I started seeing the early drawings. At first he would give me kind of, here's our original drawings of like the characters, and just watching what he did with that, I was like, wow, that's so fantastic. He's casting it on stage. I loved it.
There's no copy pasting going on. It's very eclectic.
No, very much so. Very unique looking people in that book.
Getting into comics, what did you learn about the medium or the industry you didn't know before?
That's interesting. I mean, the process itself took some adjustment for me. I mean, I didn't really realize. I mean, I guess I already always supposed, but I didn't realize how collaborative the writer and the artist are meant to be. You know, I didn't know if it was my place to really prescribe to him what to do, but he quickly showed me like, look, Matt, I got this, trust me. And he would show me stuff and I'm like, okay, so I don't need to really go through and pick apart the drawings or try to get something. It would only be when I thought that a certain notion that needed to be planted for later wasn't being revealed enough. But our collaboration started to get much more freeing, where he knew what I was trying to get across and I knew what he was going to bring to it. So I got to sort of sit back a little bit and I didn't have to micromanage as much as I thought I was going to.
Yeah.
That was a little learning curve for me. It was great to see. I mean, he's just so fantastic. There's no need to, but I thought my job would be to like, you know, look over a drawing and be like, well, can we make this bigger? Can we do that? Uh-huh. He's like, no, don't worry. This just let me go. You'll be fine. He was right. He knows what he's doing. So, I mean, that's something I learned a little bit about the process of building it. In terms of the business, I still don't know anything about it.
How were you brought in? Was Chip Mosher?
It was Chip. Yeah. So, okay, so now going back to this marquee thing from way back and Guy Davis. So my first foray into my career as a writer and also graphic novels converged in one sort of episode, and that was finding this comic book and then me thinking, oh, I'd like to adapt this. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm just out of film school. I'm going to adapt a comic book. I know how to do all this stuff. And I contacted Guy Davis and he told me, oh, sorry, I've sold the rights to Circle of Confusion and Sony. And, you know, that's that. And I was like, oh, okay. But I was so naive and young. I thought, well, I will just call them and I will tell them my great idea and they will hire me. Right.
Yeah.
And a very strange thing happened. I did call them and I said, I have a take on your book. And they said, come on in. And I said, well, that was easy. And I sat down and I pitched these executives the idea and they're going along and they're saying, this is great. This is great. We love this. This is fantastic. And they were all excited about it. And I thought, wow, this is so great. I mean, being a writer, you just sort of call them up and come pitch an idea and then you're hired. And at the end of the meeting, one of the guys said, Matt, I would usually tell the guys this after you left, but I have to go to this meeting. And he leaned to the other guys, goes, I think this guy's the next Brian Singer. I think we should hire him. And I was like, all right, yeah. There we go. They said, well, Matt, look, we're big fans. A lot of us are in the office here, are big fans of your work. I said,
Here comes a butt.
And they said, if your manager could send us some of those, I know your last movie is about to come out, but we haven't seen it yet, but we'd love to get it early. And I'm like, oh, well, guys, I just got out of film school. I don't have any, movies out. I don't have an agent. And I suddenly realized that they had mistaken me for someone else.
No.
Or that an exec, sort of that the assistant had maybe flubbed my name with somebody else. Oh, and wow. I saw their faces fall. And they said, And suddenly the guy that had the job went to, well, let us know how your career goes and keep in touch.
Oh, that's brutal.
Pushed me out the door. And I said, as the door's closing, I'm almost like a scene from a movie. I just
sliding doors.
Let me write you the first 10 pages. And they're like, yeah. Slam.
Right.
So I wrote them the first 10 pages and I dropped it off. And I got a call that afternoon. They said, we love it. You're hired. And I was like, oh, wow.
That's awesome.
Okay. So I was sort of adapting this book and Chip Mosier was at Oni Press at the time.
Okay.
So he was the executive that was overseeing the book. And I was the young, writer writing the spec. And, eventually the whole project sort of fell apart. The option was lost. I don't remember exactly how it ended, but it didn't pan out. And that was the end of that story. And then here when I was sort of contemplating wanting to do a graphic novel, I went through my phone book and I thought, well, there's a guy I know that knows something about graphic novels. So I called Chip sort of out of the blue during the pandemic and we caught up and I said, I've been interested in doing this. And he said, well, I'm working for Comixology, send me a one pager and I'll see what I can do. And I sent it. He loved it. He said, we want to do this with you.
Nice. Great.
So it's sort of funny how those old relationships, kind of come back after, so
it's all networking.
It is. Don't piss anybody off.
We had Chip on this show. Gosh, it's probably a year and a half ago now. But he's great. Great guest too.
I got to tell you, this guy knows so much about comics, and he's such a great energy. His enthusiasm about stuff is so infectious, and I can see why people love working with them. I did. It was so great to just have somebody just cheering you on and just believing in your vision and getting excited for your work. It's fantastic. He's a fantastic guy.
So once Eden was completed on your end, and maybe even after when the pages started coming in, the art coming in, was there anything you would do differently with your next project after this one?
Well, that's a good question. No, I don't think so. I got to say that the process worked pretty well for me. I mean, I would, I just want to do more of it, but there isn't something that I can look at and say like, this wasn't good. This didn't work. Or I wish I'd done that differently. I sort of feel like we had a great team of people involved, from Ricardo, from Will as our editor, who really kind of just kept the ship together all the time. Our colorist Luca was just fantastic. I just had, Ed is our letterer. Like these guys were just such pros that we just really ran together as a good team. So I there's nothing I would specifically do. I got to tell you, I'd like to say that, but I can't think of anything.
Nice. aced it first try. Boom.
When's well, I wouldn't say that, but I wouldn't necessarily do anything different.
Do you have any other comics projects in the pipeline?
Yes, I do. I've got something cooking with Chip again. Something I pitched him that I'm super excited about. It's a project that I've had. I've been developing over 10 years. Really, oh, wow. It's like a huge, huge world build project, and so I've been talking to him about that. And I have a couple others chambered. I've just got a few others. I'm thinking like these would be better for graphic novel and comics. I should do those instead of pitching them. And
nice.
Now this great new channel's opened up in my life. I can do different things. So I'm excited about that.
Are you thinking Comixology only for a lot of these projects, or are you possibly moving on to other publishers and making it the better fit?
Well, there's definitely other publishers I can look at and would be open to, but I'm also loyal to a fault in a way. I think that if I've got something great, I'm gonna go to Chip first because he gave me the shot sure. on this, and we obviously did a great job with it. I mean, the people that he put around me were fantastic, so I had a great experience with it. So certainly, he'll be my first go to. If he hates something, then I'll go somewhere else with it. Or maybe there's a bandwidth issue. Maybe I'll just want to do two different things at once, and I'll have to put one place and one somewhere else. I don't know, but they've been so good to me. It's hard to not come back to them.
Yeah, the Comixology originals line has been really great. Just very eclectic, different types of stories, and a lot of them just super good.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of that's Chip. I think it's him cultivating.
He's the Kevin Feige of Comixology.
Sure. He sure is. He'll like that or hate it. I'm not sure, but I will certainly make sure he gets that message.
I'll put it in the tweet.
There we go.
Matt Arnold's here, but also he said this about Chip. I'll tag him.
Yeah, please.
If Eden was greenlit for TV or a movie, which studio would you like it to produce it?
Oh, that's a good question. It's a stream. It would be a streaming show. I'd want to have the freedom to do it at Netflix or Amazon would be probably my go-to places, just because they have they give you a lot of freedom to do things you want to do. And I think that the darkness of it, the budget it might need, all those things would be really served in the streaming world. But there's also great possibilities of places like Hulu and other places like that that would also, I think, do a great job with it. So we'll have to play that out and see where it belongs, if it's going to be adapted. But I think it certainly has great potential for that as well.
And you're going live action?
If we were to adapt it, yeah, think so. Nice. I think so.
Before my last question, I have to ask, as a geek fanboy, you were part of the Emerald City production. Did you ever get to meet Vincent D'Onofrio, and is he awesome?
I didn't, actually, because the way that things panned out with that show is that we had originally got it greenlit, and then we had an issue with our showrunner who left the show. And then during that time that I thought the show was dead, I was under two other writing deals at two different other studios at Warner Brothers and Legendary that were first looks and second looks. And so when the show got started back up again, which was based on a lot of the scripts done in that writer's room, I wasn't on for the actual finish of it. So I didn't get to see the production take place. I tell people Emerald City to me feels like I had a great kid that was adopted and I didn't get to raise them, but they turned out really well. And I'm glad, but I wasn't really the dad on the scene. So I feel bad about that, but I'm glad the kid turned out okay.
Yeah. So, yeah. It was really, really cool production design. Oh my God, the costumes and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was really wonderful to see that vision sort of take shape. I felt like in that case, I was more like a writer for film. Writers on film don't really get to be there during the production of it. They just sort of turn over the director. And I was more than pleased. I mean, the vision of that show when I created it was to do a very dark retelling of The Wizard of Oz. I love to take stuff that's kind of cutesy and cheesy and just find the psychological depth and the darkness of it and see if I can spin it upside down. And that was really the goal of that. I feel like that was well executed. Probably too dark for NBC. I mean, I think that it was a victim of its own success in that way, because what we went for, what they allowed us to do, was really fantastic. They gave us the budget to really do it, but was it great for a mass audience? Probably not. It probably should have been better served in a streaming world where you have a niche audience that loves it. And there is audience that loves it. I still get tweets to this day about how much people just love that show.
Nice.
But getting to turn Emerald City and Wizard of Oz upside down like that was really fun.
Yeah, now I'm envisioning that show, but on HBO, what that would be like.
Yeah, well, I think it would have lasted a lot longer because, again, I think, one thing I learned in this business is that you've got to put the right show at the right channel, the right venue, mm-hmm. or it doesn't work. Even if it's a great show, it really has to find its correct home.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, do you have any other projects you'd like to talk about today?
Well, I'll just tell you a little bit. Revenge Inc. is a new show that I'm doing at Netflix that I'm creating, show running. It's a really dark show about a underground revenge company and this woman who joins it to help her get revenge and realizes that it's a lot different and darker and filled with more secrets than she had thought. So that's kind of a very cool thing that I'm excited to work on right now. And I've got other stuff in the works that I can't quite talk about, unfortunately, which I wish I could, but who knows, maybe in a month or two, I'll be able to say more. But, it's an exciting time. It's an exciting time for me just to get to play with some of these projects that I'm excited about. And, excited to jump in and tell a little more of this dark, bizarre world that's floating around in my crazy head.
Or worlds, more like, right?
Yeah, somebody, I'd say that's probably correct, yeah.
Is Revenge Inc. already filmed in the editing bay, or?
No, we're just in the writing phase. I've just turned in my first draft literally like a couple weeks ago.
Oh, so. Cool. Well, I'll be looking forward to that. It sounds like a cool concept.
Yeah, I think people are going to really dig it. It's full of a lot of twists and turns and surprises that you might expect from me now, having read Eden. But it's very dark, very edgy. It's
if you
kind
have,
of a rock song.
If you have half as many twists in Revenge Inc. as you do in Eden, I'm going to be a very happy boy.
Thank you.
Well, Matt Arnold, Eden is out now on Comixology, and you can get it in paperback format through Dark Horse. Thank you so much for being on the AFBT Comics podcast.
And thanks for having me.